definitely wasn't two guys with a saw. They absolutely had machines. Weird shit that nobody ever shows on the Giza Plateau. We'll start here. Weird shit that nobody ever shows on the Giza Plateau. We'll start here. And we'll follow this thing. Stick your camera down in there. So this is a part of an extensive conduit and channel network that runs across the Giza Plateau. And you can see this channel used to be completely covered. And it was underneath paving stone. So all of this would have been completely covered. And this entire channel runs through this area. And if we follow this, I'll show you some weird stuff over here. We'll start taking a look at some of the iron oxide deposits that are embedded in the limestone bedrock. But this is one of these channels that there is no good conventional explanation for what this part is, according to the pharaonic burial theory, right? There's lots of stuff today that we're going to see that are functional components of the Giza Plateau system that are completely incompatible with a burial, this being the first one. So this channel ran all the way down through here, and it got wider as it goes on. So through here too, you can see all of this is pneumolitic limestone. The Giza Plateau bedrock used to be the bottom of an ancient seafloor hundreds of millions of years ago. It's called the Tethys Sea. And all of this limestone bedrock was formed at the bottom of an ancient ocean, which is why
you see all
there
the shells
are shells and shit embedded all throughout this bedrock limestone. There's not a really good explanation for what this area of the plateau is.
Right.
So this thing has holes in the top of it and holes going in the side. And you can see that they were clearly carving stuff out of this area. I tend to believe that these marks right here are part of the quarrying process where they were removing stuff. And you can see tool marks all in through this area where they were using tools of some sort to excavate all of this. Channel just disappears under where the modern road is.
Oh yeah, you can see it leads
and I can show you on the other side
where it starts
where the termination of this thing. Okay, so now take a look at this. Look at all this red material.
Yep.
Okay, so this is the first piece that we're going to see of iron oxide and metallic ore minerals that permeate the bedrock of the Giza Plateau. These are hydrothermal metal ore deposits. And these things are not only subsurface, but also deep in the bedrock. We know for sure that the Giza Plateau bedrock is permeated with iron ore caves, like the Tomb of the Birds is literally an iron ore cave and tunnel system. And this material, so we have chemical analysis of this stuff, predominantly iron oxide, but also has other metals like zinc, copper, titanium, platinum, but also precious metals like gold and silver have been found in these metal ore deposits. Specifically of interest, and we'll talk about this a little later, are the silicate microspheres. So we've also found fulgurites in these iron ore deposits. So fulgurites are fossilized lightning, and we found silicate microspheres that are evidence of these fulgurites, which is indicative of high voltage electric current from lightning flowing through these iron veins. In my opinion, this iron vein network spreading across the Giza Plateau was strategically selected for the construction of the pyramids, and it was implemented like a wiring system that connects all of the components off the Giza Plateau. We'll see that as we walk around. I will show you iron veins that connect every single structure on the Giza Plateau, and it starts from the core of the Great Pyramid. If you look at the interior blocks, all of them are rough cut. None of them are perfectly hewn. The only stuff that was perfectly hewn were the casing stones on the outside. Because why work harder when you can work smarter? It doesn't matter the finish on the interior blocks. They're all rough cut and none of them are the same size. The interior core is completely rough cut. That's a huge myth that the Great Pyramid is made of 2 million rough cut, perfectly square blocks. None of those blocks are perfectly square. If you look at them, they're like round shape and they're like kind of like Legos that fit together in locking pieces. And all of these stones were actually quarried directly from the Giza Plateau bedrock. That's kind of another myth that they transported 2 million stones up the Nile.
No, it's only the king's chamber, right?
Correct. Like, yeah. So the only stones that were transported from Aswan are the red granite. The Tura comes from Tura on the other side of, it's in the Cairo area, but not too far from here. We're now on the western side of the Great Pyramid. And you see that red material leading back into the Great Pyramid in this direction, this block here?
Oh, yeah.
If you follow that vein over here, you can see that it's the same sort of red iron oxide material. And this is the beginning of what we'll see is like a web, a branching vein network. Yep, this piece right back here. And all this red is part of one big vein that's coming out from the core of the Great Pyramid. And you'll notice that all of these veins start there and then they branch out in directions across the Giza Plateau. To me, it's like one of the most important details of the Giza Plateau is this interconnected system that's linked by all these iron veins. And if you keep looking as we walk around, all of them lead back directly to the core of each one of the pyramids. So remember that the pyramids are constructed on a mound of bedrock, right? Like an anchor point that sets the whole pyramid construction directly onto the Giza Plateau. And this bedrock is permeated with those iron and metal ore mineral deposits that are branching out all across the Giza Plateau. So it all starts in the core, which is crazy to think about. The deposits themselves are naturally occurring. They're called hydrothermal mineral deposits, but they specifically selected these anchor points for the location of the pyramid construction itself because they knew how these things would function when the system was operational, which is distributing electric current from lightning strikes. My hypothesis covers a variety of different chemicals that had all sorts of applications. So starting with methane at the Step Pyramid, simple domestic uses like heating and methane lamp lighting, but it also has industrial applications like syngas for hydrogen production, creation of ammonia. That brings us to the Red Pyramid. So the Red Pyramid was making an aqueous solution of ammonia that could have had applications for agricultural fertilizers. Here on the Giza Plateau, they were making sulfuric acid and hydrochloric acid, which mainly have metallurgical and mining applications. So for processing of metal. So of course, here on the Giza Plateau, we see abundant evidence of metal ore mineral deposits that are directly linked to the chemicals that were being produced in each one of the pyramids.
You can see the red on the outside of it, and it's just been filled back in with stone, but this was a huge vein of iron into the core of the pyramid. Again, I used the comparison to a Lego, where it has male and female pieces that would have mated to lock the stones in place. So anytime you see these weird indentations like this, this is where paving stones were sitting on top of this, because this is bedrock here. And it originally would have had paving stones like this that covered the bedrock and mated with the bedrock in locking pieces. So they not only carved the bedrock to have indentations, but then the paving stones would have had other indentations that locked everything in place. You see that throughout the construction process.
So this is crazy. What we're looking at here is the foundation level on the Giza Plateau. So you got the pyramid up here, of course. But what a lot of people don't realize is that this is actually paving stones, huge slabs that have been joined together very precisely. Obviously there's missing pieces, as you can see as we scan around the plateau, there's plenty of pieces that are gone, but this is the foundation upon which they then constructed the pyramids. These incredibly tightly fitting massive blocks that create the floor.
Once you know what they are, you'll start to see them everywhere we go, these iron veins. Down here to the left, that is the descending passage that leads down into the subterranean chamber. So this descending shaft is an original part of the structure. It goes to the outside on the northern face and then down into the subterranean chamber. So these pieces here are actually part of the pieces that are red granite. These are plug blocks. They call them plug blocks. But these are huge pieces of red granite that are lodged into the bottom, like the ascending passageway that goes up to the Grand Gallery.
This is going to be fun as we meet traffic. Ooh, it's been a while since I've done this.
All right, so this pass in through here leads into the Queen's Chamber.
Queen's Chamber back that way.
All right, so you see here?
Yeah.
You're doing good. That runs all the complete length of the Grand Gallery. And look here, you can see these chisel marks where something has clearly been removed from this housing.
And right.
And you'll also see as we go up the Grand Gallery, on each side, there are also housings, and this is on both sides of the Grand Gallery, this housing here on the third tier. And they've popped something out of here. You see again the chisel marks,
yep,
where whatever was housed in this thing originally was popped out of that housing.
There. Yeah.
But it's on the same side. Yeah. So whatever it is that it's a bilateral housing that, in my opinion, is connected to these little niches that you'll see on both sides of the Grand Gallery as we go up. Mixing apparatus that was housed in all of these niches that is connected into this bilateral housing that ran the length of the Grand Gallery. So you're familiar with the schist?
Yes, yeah.
So a similar type of mechanism to that, but something on a much bigger industrial scale. Absolutely mortar in between these joints. You can see a fine line of mortar that runs through all of the joints. It's almost imperceptible because it is so immaculately executed, but all of these stones are actually mortared together. That's another myth about the pyramids that is unfortunately not true. Where there were originally three huge slabs of red granite that were blocking this passageway.
Yeah, you can see the channels.
The channels. You'll also notice these grooves on this side facing toward the King's Chamber, which is a critical component of the operation of this structure.
What do you think about the acoustics? Because I know it's not necessarily like the chemical role, but there's certainly acoustic evidence for tuning this place.
Well, no, it 100% has to do with chemicals. It's something called sonochemistry, sound chemistry, and acoustic catalysts, where ultrasound can be utilized to catalyze chemical reactions. So by inducing electric fields in a material that has quartz crystal, you are going to produce ultrasound vibrations within this, I call this system an acoustic catalyst antechamber. And that is why the antechamber has some of the most profound acoustic properties in all of the Great Pyramid. The resonance begins in the King's Chamber
but it is amplified within this system. If you actually come over here and stick your head up in through here, this area is the area that has the most profound, you can hear it showing up through this way. It's directly in this area, which is a specific part of the engineering of the structure. So we're now on the northeastern corner of the Great Pyramid. In all ancient esoteric societies, the northeast corner is always the foundation stone, the first stone that's laid in the temple. The same thing is true with the construction of the Great Pyramid. The northeastern corner of the Great Pyramid is actually bedrock. It is not cut limestone. If you walk around here, this huge corner piece, this entire piece right here, if you follow it down this way and then follow it down here, this bedrock here leads directly into this corner piece. The Great Pyramid is literally anchored into the bedrock foundation of the Giza Plateau on the northeastern corner. Casing stones are laid first to set the exterior perimeter of the structure.
Interesting.
So you set the first layer with your boundaries of the external casing stones, and then all the rest of it is backfilled on the inside so that you have a stable platform to then build the next level.
Wow.
And everything goes up level by level, starting with the exterior casing stones. Veins are leading out in this direction.
Whoa.
Like literally every area of this entire eastern side is covered with this iron vein network. And you'll see here, where are they all heading? To our first boat pit. Okay, so definitely not a boat pit. And you'll be able to see when we walk over there how all of those veins are converging down into the boat pit. But then they're also heading directly toward each satellite pyramid. All the structures on the Giza Plateau, and I've mapped this in an extensive series, I have it on my channel, Giza Plateau Iron Vein Network, where I've mapped this vein network and it connects all of the structures on the Giza Plateau. This material looks melted, and we'll see some areas where it literally looks like molten iron pouring through the limestone bedrock. Check out this area here, where it looks like a stream of iron running down through there. And this is just a small example. We'll see much bigger of these things as we continue. See that?
Oh, yeah.
It's literally a fossil.
Yes. I wonder what that is.
I'm inclined to think it's a plant of some sort.
Yeah.
Because it looks like palm fronds, but this is a fossil in through here.
It's kind of
an ancient sea fossil, sea creature, or sea plant of some sort that's now fossilized in the limestone bedrock. All right, so we're approaching the Eastern Temple of the Great Pyramid, this black basalt paving floor, which is the area that has the highest concentration of saw blade cuts all through this area. But this is also where things start to get very, very weird and immediately contradict the conventional narrative of these so-called solar boat pits. So take a look at this here. Okay, so you see the huge vein? We've been talking about these veins. You see how it starts somewhere in the core of the pyramid, and then it's leading out this way, in this direction. So we're going to follow this vein. And the whole vein system leads directly into this pit. And you'll notice if you look around from this angle here, all of this has been removed. You see these modern bricks here?
Oh yeah.
That whole thing was originally eroded out. So again, these modern bricks here, this huge eroded piece here leading down into the pit. And you can see on the other side where these veins, you see that fill in right there?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
A piece of the vein on the other side. So these veins run through the pit and down in this direction.
So these are mainstream interpretation is that these are holding pens for boats.
They call these solar boat pits that were buried along with the pharaoh.
Right.
However, okay, so now we're gonna start here, go back to these modern blocks.
Yeah.
And we're gonna follow it. Into this channel system. You see this channel running in this direction here?
Yep.
Starting from the Eastern Temple, this channel runs directly
into the pit.
So we have some severe contradictions in terms of functional components in this area that are connecting both the iron vein network and this conduit and channel system directly into these so-called boat pits. So now we'll follow the channel back toward the eastern paving, and I'll show you a couple more. We can just keep rolling because there's another part of the system over here.
Oh, I'm rolling.
Okay, so this piece here, again, if you follow this directly in that direction, is another piece of that same conduit system that leads out to a component called the so-called trial passages. And we can take a look at that because there's some weird stuff over there.
It's hotter.
And now we're going to pick back up on the trail of this conduit system, and then I'll lead you around the paving and show you the saw cut. So we have this conduit system leading again. It points directly into the huge eroded pit flowing down into the so-called boat pit. And we follow the conduit system back in through here. It ran up in this direction, in through here. You pick it up back here again. This is the same channel that leads off in that direction. We're just gonna follow it. And it literally runs underneath. So this was the paving stone. This was the floor of the temple. So this channel that we're currently walking through
was hidden below the black basalt paving stone floor of the temple. And then there's another one that leads directly into the second boat pit. So you can follow this conduit, and you can see, if you just follow it straight, you can see where this channel goes in this direction. And then there's another piece of it you can see where it would have come in through here, this part here, and you can see the termination of the channel piece here, again connecting directly into the boat pit. So this is again that same piece of channel that snakes back around.
So what do you think was being channeled through these?
This, in my opinion, is part of the product distribution network. So we're talking about infrastructure, chemical manufacturing infrastructure. So you have your manufacturing facility, and then you have all of the industrial infrastructure that connects all of the various components on the plateau that were related to metal ore mining and processing. So these are all industrial conduit connections. So now, let's take a look over here. So this is probably my favorite one.
What do you think about the arguments that these might be modern tooling marks?
It's certainly possible. There was a lot of, they actually had a modern road that used to run through here, like decades and decades ago. And when they were building the modern road, that's actually when they uncovered the fourth satellite pyramid. There's actually four satellite pyramids of the Great Pyramid.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So that is an argument that they're modern tool marks. However, on the other side of this black basalt paving, there is a saw blade cut. Chemical analysis has been taken of the material found in this saw blade cut, and it had several interesting things. First, arsenical copper, otherwise known as arsenical bronze, which is indicative of the metal saw blade. However, that's not really the most interesting part. They found angular, microscopic grains of both corundum and ilmenite. Okay, so corundum is the same mineral as ruby. It is the second hardest mineral on the planet, second only to diamond, and it was part of the abrasive slurry that was used in the cutting process. In my opinion, this is the mystery and the miracle of ancient stonework. Wasn't necessarily the composition of the blade itself, but it was the particulate abrasive slurry that was used in the cutting. So it had tiny microscopic particles of corundum and also ilmenite, which is an iron and titanium based mineral. So super hard, tiny little particles of this abrasive slurry that was used to facilitate the cutting process. And this was not necessarily proven, but certainly evidence thereof via chemical analysis of the samples that were taken. They've also taken them from these tubular core drills and found the same type of material, where there is remnants of arsenical copper, which is known as arsenical bronze, a widely used metal throughout the ancient world. And another huge myth about Egypt is they say, oh, it was pure copper, 100% copper. That is absolutely false. It was an alloy of arsenic and copper that completely changed the properties of the material. You wouldn't make anything out of pure copper because it's a really, really poor metal to make saw blade out of. However, if you add in 10% arsenic, which is actually a naturally occurring component in a lot of the copper mines here in Egypt, that arsenic is part of the ore that was being extracted. It completely changes the properties of the metal, making it a much more capable blade. And they found microparticles of corundum in these saw blade cuts. Running through this piece here,
where you can see the thickness of the blade, which is why I really like some of these. So you're looking at a blade that's about that thick.
Wow.
And the reason I disagree with the fact that these are modern, or the suggestion that these are modern, they weren't using power tools and huge saw blades up here to tear this thing apart. And we've found evidence of these saw blade cuts in other sites like Abu Sir, where it is very clearly part of the masonry process, not later destruction or dismantling of the site. All of the dismantling in quarries was done in the ancient time. It's not like they came up here with modern circular saws and started cutting this thing apart.
Right,
so
right.
I don't think that's the case. So this piece here is super interesting because it demonstrates multiple stages of the stonework process. So you can see here the fine finish. You can see here vertical saw blade cuts where they were going to remove this piece in through here and make this into a 90 degree angle. You can see where it was started with a circular tube drill here. And then this part was also going to be removed. So imagine you're working this thing to a 90 degree finish here. You go in with the vertical saw, you cut this, and then they remove this raw material out to make this a 90 degree angle here. And this piece also has some really weird anchor points where you can see here that they were using multiple sizes of tubular drill. You can see this one is about, you know, an inch and a half, 2 inches in diameter. But then if you look over here, you can see really tiny ones.
Oh, wow, yeah.
That are, you know, just about the size of a fingernail here. So they had multiple circumference or diameter, whatever measurements you want to use for the tubular drill. And then this would have been the final product of whatever was anchored in here. There was a housing for something that would have anchored down in this piece. So I think there's also a misconception when it comes to the way the saw blade actually worked. People talk a lot that it had to be a high-speed saw, when that's not necessarily the case, that it was fast in terms of RPM. What we're looking at with these cuts in Egypt is a high feed rate. So there's a difference between the speed of the blade and the amount of material that the blade removes per rotation. And what we see in Egypt is a high feed rate. Doesn't necessarily mean it was moving fast. It means that it was removing a lot of material with each rotation. The argument is against these being hand tools is that these are unintentional overcuts. Right, so if it was a manual tool and you needed to stop, you just stop. So there had to be an automated mechanical process that the saw would continue cutting even after it was stopped, at least for a short period of time, that resulted in the overcuts. You ever heard of the Hierapolis saw? It's a Roman saw blade machine that is powered by a water wheel, and it's connected by a system of gears that creates a high-speed stone-cutting saw blade, where one turn of the water wheel, by a connection of gear ratios, turns one rotation into 100 cuts of the saw blade. So the magic of the gear ratio was being utilized by the Romans, and I think they probably had a similar type of machine in Egypt that was creating these type of saw blade cuts. It definitely wasn't two guys with a saw. They absolutely had machines.